This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 6th of December, 2015, on Mongol 24.
Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is Marianne Pearl, a French freelance journalist and former reporter and columnist for Glamour magazine. In 2002, whilst pregnant with their first child, she was working for French radio when her husband, Daniel, a Wall Street Journal reporter, was kidnapped and murdered by terrorists in Pakistan. 4 months after his death, Marianne gave birth to their son, Adam. Her memoir, A Mighty Heart, details the events surrounding the murder of her husband, and it was later made into a film starring Angelina Jolie. Marianne Pearl has not allowed the horror of her husband's decapitation to beat her. She looks to ordinary women for hope, and she found it. Travelling all over the globe, writing a column for Glamour magazine, she documented the extraordinary achievements of women worldwide, compiling her work into a book, In Search of Hope. Marianne is now managing editor of Chime for Change, a global movement raising funds and awareness for women's rights and empowerment. Marianne, I'm so thrilled that you could be here today. Your current work and your extraordinary strength in the face of adversity can be traced back to another woman, your mother. You've written about her several times, and I wondered if you'd tell us a little bit about her and your early life, which wasn't easy.
My father was a revolutionary. He had grown up in Amsterdam during the war, and he had to escape, and he was Jewish, and, you know. So my early years really, like, was really fed. We were in Paris. My father then went to join the revolution in Cuba, met my mom. My father was coming from a wealthy Jewish diamond dealer, you know, in Amsterdam. And my mom was coming from this really, like, very poor area in Havana. And they both, I think, gave their life to that idea that things could be better. My mom was coming from the Batista regime, you know. My father, obviously, the Holocaust. And they put all their faith in that, you know, Cuban Revolution. So when we had to leave, because it was becoming a dictatorship, we had all these years in France, you know, which I want to write about in my new book, you know, where we all needed a goal, some big project that we could, you know, all gather around. And we didn't have that.
And your father ended up being very disillusioned by politics, didn't he? And he was a very depressed man.
Yeah, he was very depressed. But I think, you know, he really put his faith, like it was his last kind of faith of something could happen, you know, into this movement. And when that went down, he also went down. Mm. And Dad informed me very early on do not get into politics.
And he warned you against being cynical, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes. Though, you know, it was just funny because he was probably the most cynical man alive, you know. But it is the conclusion at the end, you know, being that, the conclusion at the end of his life is that, you know, it is the weapon of the weak.
So you've talked about being from Cuba. You've obviously got your father's Dutch in you, you're French, but actually you have four nationalities.
I do. So my father's Dutch, my mom Cuban, I was born in France, and then I acquired an American citizenship. When my son is American, so I acquired a citizenship as well. So I have those four nationalities, which served me very well because then, you know, I can not be from somewhere.
You describe being with your mother at her death in 2007 in the most beautiful way.
But the most important lesson of all came on the day that she died, in 1999. My brother and I stood together by her hospital bed. I loved her so fiercely that when she took her last breath, I felt like I myself was swept from the ground, observing from above the sight of my children holding my hands, my daughter bending over to kiss my lips. For that split second before I came back to myself, I felt an enormous sense of pride. I could see things through my mother's eyes. I could see whatever awaited the two children below. They would be fine. They hadn't had a perfect life, but they would make it because they'd been taught all they needed to know about courage and hope. They had become people with undefeatable faith. Today, as a mother myself, I cannot attempt to provide a perfect life for my 4-year-old son, Adam. All I want is to inspire him. I try my best to embrace the very little everyday battles, as well as the overwhelming challenge of raising him without his father. To display faith and courage, and to pass these ideals on to him. And I will always feel my mother's cosmic smile when my son and I, for no reason at all, feel an urge to play Cuban music and dance.
Well, I think my mom, you know, was an extraordinary... I think my faith in ordinary women comes from my mom, obviously, you know, because I saw it. I saw, you know, she came to France with this man who ended up being sick and depressed. She was alone. She didn't speak the language. She had two children. And mostly, you know, it was in this environment where, you know, all our friends were, you know, North African, and everybody was lost in France. And so she gathered all these kids, and we all grew up together. So, you know, was attached to in this whole revolution, Cuban Revolution, was the possibility of brotherhood and humanity. And she brought that with her because she wouldn't live without it. So that's how we grew up, you know. And so when she passed away, it was very difficult for all of us. But I thought, you know, it's only later that I realized what she had achieved, because all those children that grew up with us are fine. And a lot of it is thanks to her, because she was sometimes the only person to believe in them. You know, they wouldn't do well at school. You know, families were broken. You know, the French society was not welcoming to them. But my mom always had faith in people. And so I saw the power of that. And that's why, you know, I live my life like the way I did it.
Hers, of course, wasn't the first death of a loved one that you'd experienced. The account of the murder of your husband, Daniel's well known. But you've made sure that he's also known, or perhaps even better known, for the way that he lived his life rather than for the manner of his death. What can you tell us about his values?
His values, you know, made it that when he died, it is the way he lived that comes through, you know, in his son and his, you know, with us, in our family, then his death. And that tells you a lot about who, you know, how he lived. But I think, you know, Danny was a very open-minded person. I think he was departing from his, you know, family values. He wanted to see the world. I mean, he chose me after, like, you know, he had a list, I have to say, of potential fiancé. And I was, I don't know how long, I was in, I think I was second on the list or something. Unfortunately, the first one had a boyfriend or whatever. But he chose that, you know, he chose that way of life, which is departing from, you know, his traditions and things. So, and he had this attitude of, like, really being at ease in the world, like I am, you know, and so, and like our son is. And I'm really extremely proud of, I don't know what, of him or me or my son, I don't know, but I feel like all the values that, you know, made Danny, and one of them is being, you know, the freedom to be silly and to be all of that, he's passed them on. Like, Adam is like that, you know. So I feel like we have achieved something, and I can't tell you how it worked, you know, but I do feel that it is by standing to the values that, you know, that make you who you are, that you can somehow overcome even the worst odds.
In your book, you talk about asking him about what his religion was, not meaning any kind of theocratic way, but he said ethics.
I fell in love with him because he was the only journalist that I had met that wasn't cynical. You know, he was someone who believed in his trade. He really, really worked really hard. And, you know, really, like entirely. And so, and I fell in love with that.
The values that Danny encompassed, you appear to have carried with you, and you write that he made you believe in the power of journalism, and you've worked really hard to use that power for good. You said, though, that when you yourself became the story, you were struck by the heartlessness of some journalists.
I was having this conversation yesterday with someone, and, you know, in some ways, it's terrorism, you know, terrorists, you expect them to be terrorists. That's what they do, you know. The more complicated part, you know, for me, like in my experience, because, you know, I became the story, you know, quote unquote, but, you know, then I was privy to seeing all our weaknesses as not only media, not politics, you know, but media really, you know, hurt me more because it wasn't understandable. Like, why would you do, you know, why would you be so insensitive and running after stupid breaking news or, you know, or why are you running after what you're running if you're a journalist and it's one of your colleagues that's been killed for that, you know? That is where my understanding stops.
Journalism, of course, is changing rapidly as technology develops. And now that we have more tools at our disposal, do you think that that makes the job easier or does it encourage a different kind of reporting? Reporting maybe without responsibility?
I see everyone running for Instagram and social things and Twitter, and I don't tweet. I know I have nothing to say in 140 characters. You know, I don't. Because I feel like no system, no new invention, no new app is going to fix our problem. You know, what we need to do is to say, first of all, is our journalism adapted to our time? You know, and we can go on asking everybody questions without having the ability of questioning ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it seemed after 9/11, there was a big need for that, and it has never, you know, happened. So the same elements that, in my opinion, are bringing us in this situation, you know, greed, money, fame, all these different elements that we have a hard time dealing with, completely took over the seriousness of the situation. And so what journalists did is, like, not do that. The time called for, okay, why am I doing my job? How am I doing my job? How am I contributing to, you know, to the stereo out there? And what do I do? You know, and it's a complicated question because most people have editors that bring in, you know, it's a complicated question. But the fact that we don't even, you know, put it on the table is very worrying to me.
And the whole question of how we cover terrorism, I mean, it absolutely relies on the oxygen of publicity. Do we perhaps not cover terror? Is that one option or is that just self-censorship?
I feel like, you know, from that thinking should come the answer. You know, there's not a, you know, everybody has to come together to the table and agree on ethics, you know. Now, if terrorists produce video, well-produced, you know, technically well-produced video, it is for you to broadcast them. So, you know, the thing is, we are facing people that feed on our weaknesses, and our weaknesses is our inability to manage greed, to manage, you know, all these things that make us go, I don't know. That's the values, you know, that people go for, and they feed on that. So the only thing you can do is not do what you expected to, you know, and the media has no ability apparently to do that. So I'm not saying this is the right thing to do, this is the wrong thing to do. We don't know. We have to think about it. To me, personally, I feel like, you know, if someone is producing a video, I mean, you're doing PR for them. And it's like you, for me, you know, the image I have is like, you know, a bunch of like 30 years old that are completely gone in their head. They have technology. They're good at it. We're so easy to read in terms of our reaction. We're so predictable that they can play, you know. So I feel like, you know, Danny died like, you know, 13 years ago and that debate hasn't happened. And that is more worrying for me than terrorists. They're going to, I expect them to keep, you know, doing what they do as long as they can.
We're talking a week after the attacks in Paris, in which 129 people died. It feels really, as you were saying, that the media is in a self-perpetuating loop, feeding off each other on this story. Every statement's analysed, we see the shot from 100 different angles. How healthy is this for our society?
Maybe one thing we need to do is, first of all, separate entertainment from the news, you know. Journalists have to be serious people, I'm sorry, you know. And when you're doing entertainment, you do entertainment. Mm. And that's two different things, you know. I remember an image, I'll give you an image. You know, I was in Karachi, sitting in Pakistan, and Fox News went on. And it's the scariest thing to to watch Fox News in Karachi is the scariest thing.
To watch Fox News anywhere is scary.
It's scary, but then in Karachi it's even scarier because you say, okay, well, is that the only income you're going to have? Because there's not that many Americans around you can make friends with, right? So if that's going to be the only information you have, how is it going to shape your thing? So you have to think, I'm sorry, you know, that's, we have responsibilities. So this kind of arrogance, like, you know, wow, my freedom, you know, people need to think a bit more.
Now, you've worked personally enormously hard to get stories about women out into the mainstream. And whilst you're not entirely alone, it does seem that there is a reluctance to report on many of the stories that you've brought to light. Why do you think that is?
Well, in my life, it's all related, no? Because I have a son, my husband died as a journalist as he died. So what do I do? So I had to, you know, do I leave journalism? Because at that time, you know, I had many reasons to just, like, give up, no? And then I realized that, you know, if I wanted to do journalism, then I had to create values with it, you know. And women, I wasn't, I'm not a feminist. I'm a humanist. I don't have problems with men or anything like that. But I know that, you know, in our situation, that's why I'm calling on, like, journalists and everybody to think, you know, because there has to be a human solution. We're not going to have a social media solution, or it comes from the human heart. It has to be, you know. So that's where I found value. And I went in as a journalist, meaning that I didn't think at first that, you know, oh, great, you know, women. And I didn't have any opinion on it. I just went. And my instinct and my mom, because I knew, you know, that all her life and what all she went through, and it's never been recorded. If not for me, this story would have disappeared, you know. So how many women were like that? Mm-hmm. That was my instinct. And clearly I found that. And so the first book I did about women, it was in 18 countries. I went to see 18 women. So you have all the spectrum. There's a president and there's a cleaning lady. And throughout all these different profiles, you can see that same force coming through. And I don't know how to identify it really well, but I can. Maybe it's about justice. It's that capacity of human beings to react to injustice. That is raw, that is pure, that is genuine, and that is to be found in a lot of women.
It was a physical journey for you, but it was also a spiritual quest. And you talk about some truly remarkable women. I wonder why you needed to do that journey and how it helped you in the end.
What triggered that journey, I tell you, was a photo that Vanity Fair, I think was, took of 102 babies that were born after the 9/11 attacks. And I saw this photo, you know, and I communicated with a couple of these mothers. And obviously the question was, how do we give hope to our kids, you know? And that's what I decided to try to answer. The only thing I decided is, like, I wanted to meet women that had stood up alone, you know, not informed by social media, by anybody else, but just because of their sense of justice. And I didn't want a hope that was based in faith or, you know, anything that's not, you know. So I wanted human, concrete reasons to do that. And I found it.
Your son, Adam, named as Daniel wanted him to be after the first man, is now 13. He's had a remarkable childhood with an inspirational mother. He's travelled all over the world. And you wrote that you prayed Adam's light would shine brighter than the darkness that had claimed his father's life. Such a beautiful phrase. Do you talk with him about the circumstances of his father's death?
Well, Adam, you know, he now is 13 years old. So for 13 years now, he's gone with me. You know, we've gone everywhere. He knows so many different people and so many different spectrum of, you know, the societal, you know, ladder, whatever, that I have achieved something. Is Adam is at ease in the world. And that's what I was telling you about his father's spirit. And we haven't, you know, what was expected of us, you know, is to recoil, no? So I knew that, you know, that's exactly what I'm asking other people to do, because I'm doing it, you know, because I understand the anger and everything and, you know, the despair and all that. But he's lived with me doing that. So his connection with human beings is very strong. And I think he knows how to read a human now. So I'm happy, because I felt like, you know, it is a family somehow in a strange way. You know, it's like, I'm pretty sure if Danny shows up today, he's like going to be quite proud of his son, you know, especially of his sense of humor.
Now, you're busy ensuring a better future for the next generation, not only for your own son, but through Chime for Change, for many other children, through the work that you do mostly with their mothers. So tell me about Chime for Change.
So Chime is a big campaign that has been created by Gucci, or funded by Gucci. And it all started with one of my very best friends, Susan, who works at Gucci. And we were both so frustrated on the, you know, about the way media talked about women represented themselves. I was like, you know, it's like, come on, it can be, you know. And then we realized that so many other people were frustrated for the same thing. So how do we do that? So we were talking about this. And the more I was thinking, the more I felt like, you know, now we don't need to hear about people. We need to hear from people. So from this came, like, you know, we need a journalism platform that's for them. Storytelling for them. Because I feel like, you know, once you read a story, oh, that's a hero, she's extraordinary. Then you read, you know, 50 of them and you're like, okay, maybe there's something there. And then you realize that it's kind of like sophisticated, you know, the layers that keep them quiet for so long, and why, you know? So all of that triggered, like, what do we do? And so she brought it to another level. I mean, the concert, you know, it's fantastic. I feel like, you know, we're in a situation that we can use anybody's help. For instance, I was here in London, I went to a conference and I was on a stage with two women that are, you know, sort of hardcore feminists. And they were like, yeah, you're working with a brand and Beyonce. And you know, like it's damaging the image of the woman. I don't live in a world where I can afford to be like that. You know what I mean? Like bringing on Beyonce, whoever can help, you know? And that's kind of something very special for our time. I would say that maybe in my generation, you know, that's kind of the one big effort that is most worth it, I feel, yeah.
Well, some people, of course, would argue that Beyonce is the ultimate feminist. But so you have a lot of high-profile supporters, not only her, but many others too.
Well, I guess. I don't know.
Your journalism lab is part of that.
In March of this year, I went to Iraq because I feel like, you know, the more I was talking, you know, doing a women's issue, and I was like, my God, but what these women have to say after countless generations of, you know, I mean, of course, they're experts in justice because they've gone through so much injustice. They know everything there is to know. And then I realized that, you know, when you talk to these people who have gone through absolutely everything and they come out the other way and what they want is to contribute to society and they want to the community to go, you know, to be okay. And it's incredible. It's incredible, you know, because normally these people should be broken and should, why do they still believe in, you know, in humanity? And that made me realize that, you know, I think all the answers that we're looking for in terms of values, in terms of ethics, in terms of justice is there. They're already there. We just don't want to listen to them because we're keeping women, you know. But a lot of women have a lot to say about that, you know. So if we actually did a concerted effort to consult these people that have been, you know, the Yazidi women, don't you think? 73 genocide. Don't you think they have something to say about themselves and about how humans operate? So that's what I do. It's just, you know, I'm just a messenger, but this is out there. So if we don't want to look at it, we don't want to look at it. You know, talking about women, you know, talking about their body, talking about their looks, and it's a way of, you know, keeping them where they are. So I think we should get over this now.
You, despite what happened to you, don't appear to have any bitterness. What about forgiveness?
Okay, so there's a project called here, the Forgiveness Project, you know, that I was part of. It's very interesting. Forgiveness for me isn't, if I'm talking about my father or my, you know, my family, but for these people, it doesn't matter, you know. My point is I need to win over them, you know, it's a war, basically. So forgiveness, maybe, yeah, I don't know, maybe, you know, I'm already like way ahead, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm by trying to restore faith in the human being, an individual, I'm undoing. You know, they killed someone as a label. They, you know, they strip him of individuality. Now, you know, American, you're a Jew, you're a journalist, and I'm doing exactly the opposite. So I'm already beyond Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
You said when you first went back to Paris that you made some vows to speak out, to laugh, to take action, and to fight for peace. That's your personal war, isn't it?
Yes, but I should tell you that it's not because I'm a nice person or I have a good character. It's because I fight it every day. You know, in a situation like that, every morning and I'm a Buddhist, or every morning and every evening, I work on myself so that, you know. Because I know, like anger as legitimate, super legitimate, which is a problem because it's legitimate, but it's going to kill you, you know? So you have to understand that and you have to go over, well, you know, I'm the victim. Should I not be? No. You are in a war. And, you know, the whole terrorism thing is not, I mean, it's physical because that's the mean, but it's about the mind, you know, how they're going to manipulate your mind. So me, and I'm not the only one, I tell you, you know, but as a personal level, I was like, you're not going to touch me. And they haven't, you know, but it's a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of personal work, a lot, and every day.
Do you think that your Buddhism has helped you in that?
Yes, a lot. Yeah, because it's a philosophy that keeps me at the center of my life. No. So I think that in a situation like that, if I thought that it was, you know, the will of a higher entity or I don't know where I would go. You know, but because I, you know, I already was chanting when all of this happened and things were not, I was not confused about the situation. You know, I was not confused. I knew what he was and I knew exactly that the only way to undo what he had done is what I'm doing today. So he was on the long term and it's still on the long term. And until I die, you know, I'll claim that victory on my deathbed.
You've got a new book that you're working on. Tell me what's next for you.
I want to talk about all these stories related to my father, my mom, and this faith and how we grew up. Because I feel like, you know, like I did in Mighty Heart, now it's very important to, you know, with all the media that we have, the social media, the superficiality, now we need to go back into, like, you know, this is all about human beings, you know. At the end of the day, you know, this girl that blew herself up in Paris, you know, was a foster care kid. You know, you have to know that if you break a human being, there's no self-esteem. That's what happens, you know? And so we need the stories. We need the real, you know? And so I think my life in this way is very interesting because for the better or the worst, I have a lot of different perspectives, you know? It's like the cameras are everywhere. So I know about the suburbs, but I also know about, you know, a bit about, you know, other people at the other end of the spectrum and all that. So I've seen so many different, you know, perspectives that I have to be subtle in my thinking. It obliges me to be subtle in my thinking, you know. The other thing is that if I hadn't grown up in this environment, you know, if my childhood friends were not Muslim, if I didn't spend all my, you know, my holidays in Algeria, I would be so easy to manipulate about Islam. But, you know, when that happened, I knew already. I mean, I didn't have to struggle. It's like, this is not Islam. I know, I've grown up with these people. I know, they're my brothers, and my best, you know, it was my best man at my wedding. I mean, you can manipulate me, but because I have, somehow I'm lucky that I have this experience. But if I don't, you know, it's the same thing than sitting in Karachi and looking at Fox News. I know my American fellows, people, you know, but if I don't, then I'm really easy to manipulate. So now you start understanding the role of the media. And I'm sorry, like, you can come like, you know, like the Second World War, it was the orders, but no, not anymore. And so I'm going to write a book because that's long format. And and I think it's contributing to, I do what I can. What can I say? You know, I do what I can. So I feel like at this stage, writing this book is very relevant, actually, to, you know, what's happening today. And also the bigger question is like, okay, so what do we believe in now? It's like, how do we are confronting an ideology, people who have one thought, one decision. We are democracy, we're messy, you know, all of that. So what are the values that, you know, we're going to, what are the values that are strong enough that we can oppose to theirs? And what are we going to do to make those values real? And how much are we going to live accordingly to those values? That is what's on the table.
Marianne Pearl, thank you so much for joining me on The Big Interview here on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Georgina Godwin, in conversation with Marianne Pearl. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luthi and researched by Gaia Lutz. The programme will be back at the same time next week. That's 9 a.m. London time. But for now, all that's left to say is goodbye and thank you very much for listening.